Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about race and a little bit about gender. And in this audio snippet, we want to start talking specifically about Black people and Black people in America, to be more specific. And before that, we need to kind of give a backdrop to how things were prior to the infusion of Black people into the Americas, and specifically the British colonies that became the United States of America. So we have to get a little bit of historical context. I wish we could start directly at the moment when the slave trade started, and then go from there. But I believe that it's important to go a little bit further back and talk about certain things to have a general context to more or less get away from this idea that everything was good in the world, wonderful, and everything was perfect. Africa was living in this idyllic state of happiness and joy. And then suddenly the evil white man showed up and started taking Black people as slaves and shipping them off to the Americas. It's not that's how the liberal naive mindset thinks, but white liberalism is fraught with this lack of connect with reality. There's no connection with history, with reality. It's all this painted picture that they fashion in the canvas, and they put everything that is pleasant and convenient to their thinking, to their eyes, to their thoughts. There's a disconnect with history, with reality, what's happened in the world outside of this little bubble that we have in the United States. The white liberal doesn't understand that the world is very different from what he perceives it to be. When he looks at it from his little American, white American ivory tower. We'll give that little backdrop, and then in future audio snippets, we'll start talking specifically about slavery in America and go from there. But before we get into all of that, we just wanted to do a re-summary, you could say, of some of the things we said in the previous audio snippets about race, because I believe it's important to go over those things again, even before we start talking about Black America specifically. And we had mentioned that there were more or less five basic concepts that need to be added to the new American Constitution related to race. And the first concept, we can call it the concept of inherent equality. And we said it's the concept that that all individuals have the same inherent value and start with the same fundamental rights, regardless of race, ethnicity, or culture. And we emphasized previously that the emphasis in this principle is that we all start with the same fundamental rights, and those rights can have this fluctuation in the sense of how we handle them. If we don't exercise our rights properly, or if we don't respect the rights of others, and that's mainly the problem when we disrespect the rights of others, then our own rights can get limited. We can, in a sense, through our behavior, have our rights legally or morally or metaphysically limited. And that justifies the case, the examples, let's say, of a prisoner who is in prison, his right to life is being limited. And you would say, oh, we're violating his right to life. Well, no, because if he, let's say, murdered someone, he violated the right to life of someone else. Or let's say he robbed someone, In that case, he violated the right to property of others, and as a consequence, he then has his right to life not violated but limited. So, but the thing is, at the start, we all begin with the same fundamental rights. We all have the same inherent value, no matter what race we are, what culture we're born into. We all start with the same inherent value, and we kind of go from there. In the second principle, we can call it the principle of inherent differences. And we said that that basically that means that different races have different general attributes. So first, we recognize the inherent equality of everyone in terms of fundamental rights that we start with. And then we have to recognize, yes, even though we all have the same fundamental starting rights, we then have certain inherent differences that not all races are created the same. They, and we began to focus on the five different facets of the human personality, the judge, the visionary, the conqueror, the server, and the organizer. And that different races have different combinations of those five ingredients. And that makes them different. And that leads to certain tendencies in each race. Races that have a lot of visionary quality to them can degenerate into terrorism or other things. And let's say a race that has a lot of organizer quality can degenerate into stagnation, traditionalism, etc. So those qualities can have good effects and bad effects, and it depends on how the people of that race or that culture handle those attributes. And it's sort of like a contagious thing, where if a lot of people start misusing a certain attribute, then it kind of spreads throughout that culture, throughout that race. But at the end of the day, every individual is responsible for the things he or she accepts from the surrounding culture. So you can be surrounded by 100,000 people who think a certain way, and you could be the only one who doesn't think the same way, but that does not mean that you are then kind of condemned to be like the other 100,000. At the end of the day, you are the one who decides how you're going to behave. But the influence can be strong, and it can just grow. And sometimes a certain culture develops certain bad traits that other cultures don't develop, even if they have similar attributes. But it's a cumulative thing. And it's just a fact of life that the human being is has this, I don't know if the word is condemned, but in a sense, the human being is condemned to be influenced by other human beings. We have the ability to influence the destiny and the lives of other people. You know, just like when a man kills another person, that person has affected the destiny of that other person. Or if a man saves another person from drowning or whatever, had an influence on the destiny of the other person. So we are condemned to be influenced by the decisions of other people. And that's what leads to a lot of unfairness, what seems to be unfairness in life. But it's just that's how things are. And but at the end of the day, even though we are exposed to the influence of others and can have our lives affected in one way or another by the decisions of others, we are, at the end of the day, the architects of our own destiny. We decide what we want to embrace, what we surrender to, what we fight against, and so forth. And the decision is in our hands. Life or death is in our hands in terms of what we decide to do. And as a side note, it's important, I believe, to include in the Constitution those five categories. To mention them explicitly, and I believe it's important to mention it so that legislators, when they are drafting laws, take those things into account. So it's important to understand human nature when you're drafting laws, and understanding those five components is essential to understanding human nature. So I believe it should be included in the Constitution in under that second principle of inherent differences. As a side note, just to mention this quickly as well, even though there are five different personalities, there are also what I would call two wild card traits. But these two wild card traits are more willfully adopted rather than born with. The five that we just mentioned: judge, visionary, conqueror, server, and organizer, are traits that people are generally born with, and they can get those traits imparted to them from other people who have the trait. So you're either born with it, or you can get it from someone else as you're exposed to that other person, or you willfully seek it out. But there are two traits that are kind of wild card, where you can decide to embrace them, but it's up to you completely. You're not born with them. You either embrace them or not. And one of them is what I'd call the dreamer trait. The people who dream of great things, who are in a small state and dream of great achievements and great things. They are the dreamers who dream the impossible, even from a state of weakness and vulnerability. And then there's also the trait of prosperity, what I call the trait of peace and prosperity, where there's some people that develop a certain quality where everything that they get involved in prospers. And everywhere they go, they bring about a state of peace. It's as if they are able to somehow overcome conflicts, and they bring about peace. And that does not mean that they are peaceful people per se, because to bring about that peace sometimes requires a little bit of violence, or being able to fight against the elements of injustice or evil or whatever until they are destroyed, and then there's peace. But they have certain people just come with this aura of prosperity. Whenever they get involved in something, it just prospers, and then things work out, and things become abundant, and there's peace and harmony, and also, as we said, there are people who are dreamers. But it's something that you decide to do. You're not born with it. It's something that you have to go out and embrace and grab it, and then you start living it out. And then the third principle that will need to be added to the New American Constitution is what we can call the principle of superior or inferior patterns. And we said that basically means that it's valid to declare that people of a certain race, ethnicity, or culture develop certain patterns of behavior, where some of those patterns are good and some of them are bad. And it's important to put that in the Constitution, because it kind of protects us from the accusation of racism when we're saying black people tend to do this, or Hispanic people tend to do that. It's not racism. It's saying, no, racists have patterns of behavior, and some of them are good, and some of them are bad. And the fourth principle that we had discussed before is what we can call the principle of identity, to be more precise, the principle of immutable identity. And it's the principle that race, ethnicity, or culture does not define identity, that every individual forges his or her own destiny and identity. And race, ethnicity, and culture do not define identity because they are circumstantial. They can vary. You can be born into a certain culture, a certain race, or certain ethnicity, but that does not define your identity, because that means that you'd be more or less condemned to or be the victim of where you were born into, and that's not correct. Those are variables that are circumstantial, but your identity is immutable. It has to depend on things that do not depend on circumstances, and that's an important principle that must be in the Constitution. Legislation must be drafted with that in mind. And then the fifth principle is what we can call the two-gender principle, that there are two human genders and that they have important and distinct functionalities in the human experience, and that legislation cannot force the suppression of one of the genders or the denial of the differences between the two. And so we spoke of how the male gender has certain qualities, mostly the first three of the five personalities, judge, visionary, and conqueror, they're mostly male qualities. They're more prevalent in men than in women. And then the other two, server and organizer, are more innate, you could say, in women than in men. Men are producers, individual producers. Women are collective nurturers. In patterns, that does not mean that a woman cannot be a conqueror. It doesn't mean that a man cannot be an organizer. But we're talking about it in terms of general patterns, and that in general, because of man's individuality, inherent strength, and all these other factors, and the fact that they tend to be more judgment-oriented, more visionary, and more conqueror-oriented, that they the male gender tends to, by nature, be a little more dominant than the female gender. But that means that there's a responsibility there, that just because there's a natural dominance that emerges does not mean that the man can suppress and humiliate the woman or take advantage of her. Just as we recognize that there are these two genders, they have different functionalities, one more a little more dominant than the other, then we recognize that, but at the same time we say, okay, we have to protect the more vulnerable woman from the dominant man, to protect her from being abused by the dominance of man. But that does not deny the natural dominance of man. It's just saying, no, we are not going to let man take advantage or abuse his more natural dominance. And by the same token, we are not going to allow a woman to artificially emasculate man just to become the more dominant gender. So the legislation has to be drafted always to protect or fight against the suppression of one of the genders, either the male or the female gender, and also it has to fight against the tendency we have currently of denying the differences between the two. I believe we needed to mention all of these things one more time. And as another side note related to the principle number two of inherent differences, when we talk about those five qualities, that's what basically the second principle that we mentioned, that we're calling the principle of inherent differences, is the principle of, you know, using the liberals' lingo, it's the principle of diversity. This is diversity. When we recognize the diversity of the human spectrum. See, the problem is liberals tend to think of diversity in terms of like stupid stuff, cultural stupidities. like, for example, all that we love the diversity of people wearing different clothes. You know, if you walk down the street and we see a woman wearing a burqa, and someone else wearing a kimono, and some other guy wearing a toga, and all of them wearing their native attires, then that's diversity. That's what we want. Really, do we really care, you know, if someone's wearing a kimono or a toga? Is that what, you know, is diversity this Halloween party where everyone's going to be wearing something different and that's what makes us diverse? That's stupid. Or diversity of food or whatever. Yeah, it's nice to have diversity of food or different flavors to try, but that's not diversity. What is diversity is recognizing there are people who are visionary, there are people who are law-oriented trailblazers. That's what the judge does. Or that they're conquerors, or that they're this and that. When you form a company, it's good to have people from the five elements. To have the diversity. You can't have everybody just being judge, because that causes problems. You can't have everyone being visionary, because then you'll have a company that's out of control, just being visionary, but with no law, no restraint. And you can't have a company without conquerors, because then the company will never expand, never progress. You can't have a company without organizers, because the organizer, as the name says, organizes structures and so forth. And you can't have a company without servers, because servers are the people who please others and provide a service and so forth. So that's the diversity we need. Not the diversity of different clothing styles. Pardon my French, but who the hell cares? Who really the hell cares? Or different skin colors. That's not diversity. If you have a white, a black, and a Hispanic, and they're all crazy nutjob liberals who think the same way. Liberalism is the server. Has the server quality gone astray, you could say? Liberalism has a lot of that server quality just degraded. So they all have the same mindset. They all think with a server mentality, but in a distorted way. Then there's no diversity. Who cares? No one cares if the three have different skin colors. They're all acting like three idiots at the same time. That's not diversity. So if we want to include diversity in the Constitution, in the New American Constitution, it's in this principle, but not as the liberals understand it. So now that we have kind of gone back and reviewed a little bit of the past on racist, let's now actually get going with the topic of this snippet regarding Black America. And to start talking about that, we have to look at the issue of slavery in the past. Before the Americas were discovered, how was slavery? What was the state of the people in Africa, and so on? Just so you may know, slavery was not invented in the 1500s. There's been slavery throughout human history, as some of you may know. And just to give you just a very quick example, if you think of slavery in the Iberian Peninsula, you know, the Iberian Peninsula is the western part of Europe, where you'll find Spain and Portugal. And Gibraltar, which is part of the UK, the Iberian Peninsula experienced slavery for a long time, and mostly because of the Muslim invasion. As you may know, the Muslims invaded the Iberian Peninsula and conquered it, and held it for a long, long time, and they engaged in a lot of slavery. There are stories of how they would sometimes go into a town and massacre Jews and enslave the Jews, women and children. And they engaged in a lot of slave trade and so forth. So slavery was happening a lot in the Iberian Peninsula. We're talking about the 700s, 800s, around that time. And there's a lot of slavery. If you look in the Arabic world, in general, there's a lot of slavery going on, including a lot of slavery of Europeans, which is ironic because usually people don't think of white people being enslaved, but the Arabic people enslaved a lot of people, including Europeans, in the pre-Muslim and post-Muslim Arabic world. So even before Mashuga, the prophet of the Muslims, came along, the Arabic world was engaged a great deal in slave trading. And also the Roman Empire had a lot of slavery. As you may know, and just if you doubt it, just think of Spartacus, you know, like in the movie. Spartacus led a rebellion, a slave revolt within the Roman Empire. He almost succeeded. But he, you know, his presence in history just confirms that there was slavery in the Roman Empire for a long time. And Africa itself had a lot of slavery for centuries prior to the Atlantic slave trade. You know, slaves were being traded within Africa and to Europe and Asia, as we'll more or less describe a little bit later. And the Romans enslaved a lot of Africans, and not just Africans. They had this practice of going into a territory, conquering it, and from the conquered peoples, they would start taking slaves. And so it was not that the Romans were fixated on catching black slaves and so forth. It was just that wherever they went and conquered, they would enslave people, and that included Africans. Just to give you an idea of the state of slavery in Africa, there was a Scottish explorer of West Africa. His name was Mungo Park. And around 1796, he wrote the following, and I'm just going to read it verbatim. He said, in a book written around 1796. Now think about it, 1796, that's 20 years into the Declaration of Independence in the U.S. So he is in West Africa, he's writing this book, and he's saying that the slaves in Africa, he said, I suppose, are nearly in the proportion of 3 to 1 to the free men. They claim no reward for their services except food and clothing, and are treated with kindness or severity according to the good or bad disposition of their masters. Custom, however, has established certain rules with regard to the treatment of slaves, which it's thought dishonorable to violate. Thus, the domestic slave, or such as are born in a man's own house, are treated with more lenity than those which are purchased with money. But these restrictions on the power of the master extend not to the care of prisoners taken in war, nor to that of slaves purchased with money. All these unfortunate beings are considered as strangers and foreigners who have no right to the protection of the law, and may be treated with severity or sold to a stranger according to the pleasure of their owners. So there was a culture of slavery in Africa itself. And as this fellow was saying, he, from his observations in West Africa, he saw a proportion of 3 to 1 of slaves to free men. So the majority of people were being enslaved. And you would say, oh, this is the white man enslaving them. Well, not necessarily, as we'll describe later on. And so we're seeing that going back to antiquity, to the Roman times, Africa was experiencing slave trade. And not just the Romans trading, it was the Africans trading amongst themselves. And just to give you an idea of that, human sacrifice was common in the West African states up until the 19th century. Think about that. Human sacrifice, 19th century, that's the 1800s. So we're talking about the time when, the first century, the first full century, you could say, of American existence as a nation in the 19th century, when a lot of discoveries, technological, scientific discoveries were being done, 1800s. The Industrial Revolution, all this stuff going on in the West, in Europe, and here in America. And at that time, at the same time, in West Africa, the African kingdoms there were practicing human sacrifice deep into the 19th century. Now, that tells you how much they valued each other as human beings. So, people here talk about Black Lives Matter. Well, inside West Africa, black people were sacrificing each other. That's how much Black Lives Matter to other black people. And human sacrifice, where I read this from, it, because they are trying to kind of soften this up a little bit, and because there's always this bias when you read about these things, when you get this information, you have to remember that the people who are writing this tend to be liberals, and they like to soften it up when it doesn't make their agenda look good. So they write here that it's not clear on whether human sacrifice was present before European contact, but I'd be surprised that because of European contact, the people of West Africa said, oh, let's have human sacrifice. Clearly, this must have been going on way before the Europeans showed up. But the thing is that when it came to these sacrifices, slaves were the most prominent choices. So, when they had to decide, okay, let's sacrifice someone, they would tend to pick slaves. So they had slaves, black people, owning other slaves. Black slaves. And just to give you an idea, there used to be this yearly celebration in the kingdom of Dahomey, D-A-H-O-M-E-Y. And this kingdom of Dahomey in West Africa had this yearly celebration called the Annual Customs of Dahomey. And it was celebrated in Dahomey, the capital of the kingdom of Dahomey. And apparently this celebration, I don't know if you can call it that, started around 1730. Think about that, 1730, 18th century. In the 1730s, we in America were at the beginning of what I would call the beginning of the end of slavery. But America, being stupid as it has always been, kind of delayed that by at least 100 years. When we get to that eventually, you'll see what I mean by why around the 1730s, it's as if that was the decree when slavery was going to have to start tapering off and ending. But we didn't get the message. But going back here to the annual customs of Dahomey, which started around 1730, they would sacrifice around 500 prisoners in human sacrifice in the celebration. So they had this, festival, and in the festival, around 500 every year, 500 human sacrifices. And they were sacrificed apparently to honor deceased kings of the past. They had their dead kings, and to honor the souls or the spirits of these dead kings, or whatever reason they had, they would just engage in these human sacrifices, just killing people, just just for the fun of it. And Dahomey was a significant military power at the time. You know, it was a black military power, a black military kingdom. And instead of using its black military power, let's say, to fight against the Europeans and fight and stop the slave trade or whatever, they kind of relished the presence of the Europeans and not only helped them and provided them with slaves, but had slaves themselves and used them for sacrifices and so forth. And they would also sacrifice prisoners of war, you know, POWs, you could say, that they would capture, or criminals, they would just kill them. And it's reported that there was one year that as many as 4,000 people were sacrificed in this yearly festival. So that tells you how much black lives were valued in black Africa by black kings and black kingdoms. Let's move on from this a little bit, and let's also talk about the Arabs, the Barbary corsairs, you know, the Muslim pirates, you could say, or the Arab pirates. According to the calculations of some historians, between 1 and 1.25 million Europeans were captured and enslaved by Barbary corsairs or Barbary pirates between the 16th and the 19th century. So between the 1500s and the 1800s, you know, that 300 to 400 year span, around 1 to 1.25 million Europeans were captured and enslaved by Barbary pirates and sold, you know, into North Africa and the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, North Africa, you know, Algeria, modern day Morocco and Tunisia and all of that, and the Ottoman Empire, which would be, you know, around the area of Turkey. So white people being enslaved and shipped off, and this is never spoken of in, you know, in the liberal narrative, but this is just a part of reality, a part of history. And some argue that those numbers might be a little bit inflated, and because that doesn't take into account that Barbary pirates also enslaved, as I was reading earlier, that, oh, this might be inflated because it doesn't take into account that Barbary pirates also enslaved non-Christian whites and people of other races. Oh, wonderful. But that doesn't take away from the fact that they were enslaving whites. And they also like to focus on Christian whites. It was their way of showing the superiority of the Arab or Muslim culture over the Christians. So there was a lot of slavery going on there. And I'm just going to read an excerpt here from a book in 1731. On the history of Algiers by a fellow named Morgan, obviously not Captain Morgan, but some Morgan fellow, or maybe it was Captain Morgan, I don't know. But there was a fellow named Morgan in 1731 who wrote a book, and he wrote, I'm going to read verbatim, "Those who have not seen a galley at sea, especially in chasing or being chased, cannot well conceive the shocks such a spectacle must give to a heart capable of the least tincture of commiseration. To behold ranks and files of half-naked, half-starved, half-tanned, meager wretches, chained to a plank from whence they remove not for months together, commonly half a year, urged on even beyond human strength with cruel and repeated blows on their bare flesh." So he's talking about, you know, the very brutal cruelty that he saw in these Barbary corsairs, Barbary pirates, and how they treated the slaves that they captured. And So Barbary corsairs were engaged in slave trading, and they were not whiteys enslaving people, and they were actually enslaving whitey a great deal, and doing it very harshly. And the Christian kings, and I find it funny when I read this, they emphasize that they were the Christian kings. Because Christian is bad to liberals. So the Christian kings of the Ethiopian Empire often exported pagan slaves from the western parts of their kingdom or from conquered or reconquered territories. And this is a fact. And they were, I guess, technically Christian, if you can call it that. Ethiopia had an infusion of Christianity from very early on because they had a strong Jewish base. And they were exposed to Christianity because they would travel a lot they would do their pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And just like in the story in the Bible, it talks about this Ethiopian eunuch who converted and went back to Ethiopia and kind of took the gospel, the Christian gospel, over to Ethiopia. So Ethiopia has this tradition, you could say, of Christianity and Judaism from very early on, even though they're black, but they were very Jewish and Christian. And these Christian kings, unfortunately, engaged in slave trade. And we're not talking about white Ethiopians. We're talking about black Ethiopians. And slavery in Ethiopia was mostly domestic and targeted women. So they like to have, their mates as slaves. They are serving in the house and so forth. And slaves in Ethiopia were considered second-class people. There was one emperor who tried to abolish slavery, like the first one who did, the first Ethiopian emperor. And notice we're saying emperor. We're talking about a black empire. And the Black Empire, instead of saying, okay, we're going to rally our people to fight against slavery because this has to stop, this has been going on for centuries, and we're not going to take it anymore, or we're not going to allow it to happen. Instead of doing that, they were engaging in it. Even with the Christian influence, they were engaging in it. There was one emperor who said, okay, let's stop this. He tried to abolish slavery, and his name was something like Tewodros II. And he ruled, just to give you an idea, from 1855 to 1868. Think about that, 1855 to 1868. The American Civil War was fought between 1861 and 1865. So we're talking about more or less a time period when slavery was about to be abolished, or at least officially, in America. And all the way over in Ethiopia, there was this emperor who said, okay, it might be a good idea to abolish slavery. But he was unable to do so. And the slave trade was eventually abolished in Ethiopia in 1923. Think about that, 1923, way into the 20th century, 1923. And why was it abolished? Not because the Ethiopians, the black Ethiopians said, oh, okay, enough of this slavery stuff. We're not supposed to be enslaving each other. No, the reason why it happened was that Ethiopia, entered the League of Nations. And as it entered the League of Nations, then it felt obligated to end the slave trade. In order to be part of the League of Nations. And it's estimated that there were still 2 million slaves in the 1930s in Ethiopia out of a population of around 8 to 16 million people. So if we take the conservative estimate that there were 16 million people in Ethiopia, 2 million were slaves. That's one out of every eight. If we take the less conservative estimate of 8 million, that means that one out of every four Ethiopians was a slave in the heart of Africa, a black empire that had a population where one out of every 4 to 8 Ethiopians was a slave. In the 1930s, we're not talking about the 1500s or the 6th century BC, the 1930s. And slavery continued until 1935. And again, it wasn't because the Ethiopians said, this has to stop. It's because in 1935, the Italians, and it might have been Mussolini, I'm not too sure about that, but I guess it must have been Mussolini, sent his army, I don't know why, but he went into Ethiopia, invaded it, and occupied it. And when the Italians arrived, one of the first things they did was to abolish slavery. And don't you think that's a little bit ironic? The white man had to come to say, enough of you black people enslaving each other, we're going to abolish it. The conquering whiteys were the ones who ended slavery in Ethiopia, in black Ethiopia. So that's just to give you a context of the problem of slavery is not restricted to whitey and the American South. It's been going on, and there's something there. And black people should wake up and say, pardon my French, but what the hell is going on? Why has this been happening for so many centuries with us? And we enslaving each other. What is wrong with our culture, our value system? There's something genetic there. There's a problem that hasn't been dealt with. And then if you go into Central Africa, there you also see slavery. In Central Africa, you have a history of slaves being transported across the Sahara from antiquity, and that was the Roman Empire that had a lot to do with a lot of that slave trading. But it's not just the white Romans. It was also black people again. There was a kingdom in Central Africa, the Kingdom of Congo, which is more or less part of what is today modern day Congo. And the Kingdom of Congo had slavery long before the Portuguese arrived there. And once the Portuguese arrived, then the Kingdom of Congo began to provide slaves to the Portuguese. So it's like, instead of trading sugar or some mineral or something, instead of that, they started trading slaves with the Portuguese, the Kingdom of Congo. See, we're not talking about some little tribe or some little merchant here or there. We're talking about an official kingdom that had power, that had an army, that had a system, a structure of government, a black kingdom of Congo. And they had slavery before the Europeans showed up. And the Europeans arrived and said, oh, there's slavery going on here, and maybe we can take advantage of this because we need the labor. And the Portuguese needed labor. We'll explain later why. The Portuguese were the ones who started the whole slavery thing, at least the European slave trade, the modern, or you can call it modern European slave trade, when the New World, in the Age of Discovery, the Portuguese were the ones. People don't really know this, but they were the ones who kind of got the ball rolling with the slave trade. And I've never seen anyone protesting against the Portuguese, but they were the ones who started this whole thing in many ways. And this just goes to show you how little we know about slavery. And we're not talking about dark facts or conspiracy theories. This is just plain stuff that if you look it up, it's right there. Even the liberals aren't hiding it. They just don't bother to hide it because no one's looking for it. So I guess it's okay. If it were more well known, they would try to massage it or hide it so that people would know it. But it's right there, and everyone knows it. You go to history, that's everything we're saying here is there for you to find. But instead, we know very little. And we have this tunnel vision. We just think that slavery was invented by some evil white man in the American South. And the white American is the most evil creature on the face of the earth. And it's not like that. It goes way back. And Whitey has nothing to do with it in many cases. And if we go to West Africa, sadly, the Atlantic slave trade, people argue that there wasn't much slavery going on in West Africa, that it was minimal. I don't know. Maybe it was, or maybe it's the liberals just massaging it. But it is admitted, even by the liberal historians, that once the Atlantic slave trade started, once the Europeans started trading slaves and so forth, that kind of fomented or led to an uptick of domestic slavery in Africa. So in other words, when these kingdoms were, began to trade slaves with the Europeans, they said, oh, okay, now that we're trading slaves, let's have some of our own. So they started owning slaves, black people in these kingdoms owning slaves. And because it was lucrative. So they would just go and see, the thing is, it wasn't Whitey chasing a black guy across the jungle to capture him and put him on a ship. It was the black people of Africa who were chasing down other black people, grabbing them and using them as trade coins with the Europeans to get stuff from them. So they were benefiting from it. So they would hunt down, conquer other territories and grab their population and sell them to the Europeans. And then they grabbed some slaves for themselves. And we're talking about a lot of kingdoms. I can read you the list here. Like there was a state called the Bono State, and nothing to do with the U2 singer, or the Bono or Bono State. There was the Oyo Empire, or also known as Yoruba. There was the Kong Empire. There was the Imamate of Futa Jalon. There was the Imamate of Futa Toro, the Kingdom of Koya, the Kingdom of Kaso, the Kingdom of Kabu, the Fanti Confederacy, the Ashanti Confederacy, and the Kingdom of Dahomey that we mentioned before, that the human sacrifices. And I know you might never have heard of these kingdoms. They're not relevant historically, and other than to point out there were these black kingdoms, these kingdoms in Africa, well established, that instead of joining to fight the Europeans and say, no, we want to be free, and we're not going to let our own people be used as slave pawns. Instead of that, they benefited from the Europeans having a need for black, free black slave labor. And that tells you a lot, because why were these kingdoms so willing to do it? In part because they, in a sense, feared the white man a little bit, that the white man was more powerful than they were. But instead of saying, okay, let's try to advance technologically, let's try to progress our cultures to go beyond our primitive current state and become more powerful so that we can be independent and not be subject to this slave trade. Instead of going there, they just said, oh, great opportunity, a way to make a quick buck. And you see this every day in Black America. It's this, that same spirit, that same mindset, that same cultural attitude. It's like it's in the DNA. It's like a curse. And that's why you see Black people on the streets selling drugs to each other. That's the same principle. They are selling drugs to enslave their Black brothers and sisters to drugs. And so they're making these their brothers and sisters slaves to drugs so that they can get money and have benefit from it. I don't know if you see what I'm trying to say. It's instead of uniting to overcome as a people, and they unite, but just to do BLM rioting and looting and all these things. But that's the extent of their unity. And just like black people doing human sacrifices, you see it in the streets of Chicago, the streets of New York, the streets of Baltimore, where I grew up, where it's black people murdering each other, Detroit, certain parts of LA, and so forth. Black people with no regard for the lives of other black people and willing to subject them to human sacrifice. So there's something there, and we have to recognize it. And just to keep talking about West Africa, in the Senegal region, Senegal is on the west coast, more or less of Africa. In the Senegal region, it's estimated that between the 1300 and 1900, so like in other words, between the 14th and the 19th centuries, a third of the population was enslaved. A third, imagine that. And we're talking about starting from 1300. Whitey had not, the age of discovery had not started. The Atlantic slave trade had not started yet. The Americas had not been officially discovered. So even in the 1300s, Senegal, that region, had a culture of slavery, where one third of the people were enslaved, the population. And in the early Islamic states that included parts of Ghana, Mali, and modern day Sudan, about a third of the population was enslaved. In Sierra Leone, in the 19th century, 1800s, about a half of the population was enslaved. In Sierra Leone, about a half, imagine that, into the 19th century. While we had slavery here in America, they had slavery in Sierra Leone, in black Sierra Leone, a half of the population was enslaved. If you look at the Vai people, V-A-I, they were an ethnic people in Liberia, Sierra Leone. And we'll talk about Liberia too. Liberia is very strongly connected to Black America. I don't know how many people really know that. But if you don't, you should. If you're an American and you don't know this, you should look it up. Liberia is strongly related to Black America. But there was an ethnic people, or there are, and I don't know if they're still around, an ethnic people in the Liberia, Sierra Leone area called the Vai people. In the 19th century, three quarters of their people were enslaved. In other words, there was one free Vai person for every out of every four. So they were practicing slavery. Being enslaved and enslaved by others and enslaving themselves. And if you go, that was West Africa. If you go to the African Great Lakes, that's the part that includes the area around Lake Victoria, the second largest freshwater lake in the world, if I'm not mistaken. And that's kind of more or less towards the east of Africa. There's evidence that there was slavery going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. We're talking about East Africa, if I'm not mistaken, more or less below the Horn of Africa, so below Ethiopia. So it's not on the western side that's close to the Atlantic. We're talking about the eastern side. And there was a lot of sea trade to Persia, China, and India. From that part of Africa, during the first millennium AD, and slaves are mentioned as a commodity, maybe not as important as gold and ivory, but even in the first century AD, there were black people being traded as slaves to Persia, China, and India. That's how far back slavery has been there. It's like this thing hovering over the continent, and black people kind of enabling it too, from the beginning. No other race has had this phenomenon as intensely as black people, if you think about it. Even though all races, including whitey, has experienced slavery, as we were saying a moment ago, the Barbary pirates enslaved a great number of white people. But the black people have this unique connection to slavery, even from before. And you have to wonder what is going on there. Okay, so if we continue, in 1814, there was an explorer from Switzerland called Johann Burckhardt, who wrote of his travels in Egypt and Nubia. Nubia is, I think, the region right below Egypt. And that's on East Africa, you know, right near Israel. So it's in the northeastern part of Africa. And he saw the practice of slave trading. We're talking about 1814. Remember that, the 19th century. He wrote, "I frequently witnessed scenes of the most shameless indecency, which the traders, who were the principal actors, only laughed at. I may venture to state that very few female slaves who have passed their 10th year reach Egypt or Arabia in a state of virginity." And you know what that means, you know, that these young women, slave women, were being raped as they were being traded into Egypt and Arabia. Notice, it's not slave trade to the Americas. It's because, by the way, you might not know this, but the slave trade in America was abolished. The importing of slaves was abolished on January 1st, 1801. Very few people, if any, know this in America, that in January 1st, 1801, the U.S. officially outlawed the importing of slaves from Africa. So no more slave trade from Africa, because ironically, even slave owners like Jefferson, who was about to take office later that year in 1801, because this happened during the term of the second president, which I think was Adams, you know, when he was in at the end of his term. But the thing is, Thomas Jefferson spoke out against the evil, which is kind of ironic, the evil of going to Africa and kidnapping people and dragging them across the ocean to America. They felt that was too cruel. So it's ironic because they did recognize the cruelty in that, but they kind of had had this little blind eye to the cruelty of slavery once, you know, for the slaves who were already here. The thing is, by 1814, when this was being written by this Swiss explorer, there was no more trade of slaves, at least to the United States. So we're talking about trade from Africa up into Egypt and Arabia, which is right next door. And the Swiss explorer was talking about the barbarities, and a Swiss explorer, whitey, looking at this and saying how black people are being treated by the Arabs and the same black people. He was seeing the barbarity of it and writing about it in 1814. And another whitey named David Livingstone, the evangelist, he wrote also in his journals a lot about the cruelty of slavery. And I'm going to read some entries from his journal in 1866. Remember, think about that. 1866, that was 1 year after the end of the American Civil War that was fought between 1861 and 1865. He wrote in 1866, the year after slavery was finally abolished, at least officially in America. He wrote on the 19th of June of 1866, he wrote, "We passed a woman tied by the neck to a tree and dead. The people of the country explained that she had been unable to keep up with the other slaves in a gang, and her master had determined that she should not become anyone's property if she recovered." So, you know, they had to leave her behind, but he just could not bear the thought of her just being free. So he just killed her, and just hung her, because, you know, if I can't keep her, she can't be free, and no one can have her instead of me. And then he wrote one week later, on the 26th of June of 1866, he wrote, we passed a slave woman shot or stabbed through the body and lying on the path. A group of men stood about 100 yards off on one side and another of the women on the other side looking on. They said an Arab who passed early that morning had done it in anger at losing the price he had given for her because she was unable to walk any longer. Same idea. Like, if she can't come with me and I can't take her, I'm going to kill her here. I don't even want her free. I'm going to kill her. And the people were looking on. She was stabbed and lying on the path, and people were just staring. And you can imagine these people staring were black people. Instead of rallying around this woman, I don't know if she was alive. Maybe she was already dead. Who knows? But they were just looking on, and they had witnessed the cruelty, and no one did a thing about it. And by an Arab, and I know that's not politically correct, but it wasn't a whitey, it was an Arab, a Muslim, a follower of Meshuggah. And then on the very next day, on the 27th of June of 1866, he wrote, David Livingstone wrote, "Today we came upon a man dead from starvation as he was very thin. One of our men wandered and found many slaves with slave sticks on, abandoned by their masters from want of food. They were too weak to be able to speak or say where they had come from. Some were quite young." This horrible cruelty was happening in 1866 in the heart of Africa, by Arabs and by black people, other black people enslaving other black people. And so there's something going on there. So now that we've kind of given a very kind of disorganized and random talk about slavery and how it's been going on for all this time, and how black people in Africa have enabled it and benefited greatly from it, we will start talking more specifically about the Atlantic slave trade in the next audio snip, and then we'll start talking in more detail about slavery in America per se, and we'll go from there. Thank you very much for listening.